arrested after mass protests in Russia, and now Russian police have arrested more than 4,000 people as supporters of the jailed Kremlin opposition leader Alexei Navalny demand his release from jail. AP correspondent Sarah Bassett reports.
Russian authorities have mounted a massive effort to suppress demonstrations after tens of thousands rallied across the country last weekend. Yet despite threats of jail, online warnings and tight police cordons, the protests again engulfed many cities. Anti-corruption investigator Navalny is Putin's best-known critic. He was arrested earlier this month after returning from Germany, where he spent 5 months recovering from a nerve agent poisoning that he blames on the Kremlin. Russian authorities have denied this. The United States has urged Russia to release Navalny and criticize the crackdown on protests. I'm Sarah Bassett.
A huge explosion happened near a popular hotel in the Somali capital Mogadishu on Sunday. Witnesses say the massive blast was near Hotel Afrique, located in the vicinity of a busy security checkpoint en route to the Mogadishu airport. Militant group Al-Shabaab claimed responsibility. Police say Al-Shabaab members stormed the hotel, but that most of the people inside were rescued, including Somalia's former state minister for defense. A VOA reporter, Abdi Kafi Yusuf Aydin, was also inside the hotel at the time and survived. A World Health Organization-led team of experts investigating the origins of the COVID-19 virus visited the wet market at the center of the pandemic on Sunday. You can read more about their visit and the investigation on voanews.com. This is VOA News. A car bomb exploded in northern Aleppo, leaving at least 5 people dead and more than 25 people injured, according to Syria's Al-Watan newspaper Sunday. State news agency Sana reported the bombing in the city of Azaz, but did not say how many people have been killed or injured. Turkey, which is allied with some rebel groups opposed to Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, is in control of the area where the explosion occurred. A separate suicide car bombing at a checkpoint manned by the Turkish-backed Free Syrian Army in the Baza area, also in northern Aleppo, killed 6 FSA members and injured 4, according to FSA sources. With a little more than a week to go before former President Trump's second impeachment trial, there's a major shakeup on his defense team. AP correspondent Ben Thomas reports.
Two people familiar with the situation tell the Associated Press the defections include Trump's 2 lead impeachment lawyers and 2 former federal prosecutors from South Carolina. The reason? A difference of opinion on what the defense should be. One person tells AP Trump wants to repeat the same allegations of election fraud that have been refuted by election officials of both parties and his own Justice Department, but that he used to stir up a crowd of supporters on January 6th, who then marched to the Capitol and stormed it. Other Republicans have made a simpler case, questioning the constitutionality of the impeachment because he's no longer in office. Trump's set to stand trial in the Senate the week of February 8th. Ben Thomas, Washington.
An Israeli official said Sunday the nation could begin overcoming the COVID-19 crisis after fully vaccinating a third of its population. Launching what has become the world's fastest vaccine rollout on December 19th, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu set protecting Israel's most vulnerable citizens as the benchmark for a possible reopening of the economy in February. But a projected mid-January turnaround in curbing the spread of the illness did not happen. Despite a third national lockdown, cases and deaths have surged among the part of the population that has not yet been vaccinated. Officials blame this on the highly contagious foreign variants of the coronavirus. Italian politician Matteo Renzi says he'd like to see former European Central Bank chief Mario Draghi become prime minister. Reuters reports a party source spoke about Renzi, who triggered Italy's political crisis this month by pulling his Italia Viva party out of the ruling coalition. Via remote, I'm Liz Pelka, VOA News.
From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. On the panel this week, via Skype, Molly Ball, national political correspondent for Time Magazine, Linda Feldman, Washington Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor, and our moderator is Shana Estulin, political and foreign affairs correspondent.
Welcome, everyone. Here are the issues. Lawmakers trigger the Trump impeachment trial, but there are increasing signs Democrats won't have enough Republican support to convict the former president. Also, Biden signs a flurry of executive orders. What does it tell us about the new president's agenda, and what can we expect from Biden's relationship with Congress? Plus, the Biden administration promising to boost vaccine supply, but getting enough shots into people's arms still proving to be a challenge. Molly, Linda, a real treat to have you both on this week, especially as we try and sort out some political gamesmanship on Capitol Hill. I know you both will help us get through the impeachment forecast and some other pressing topics. Let's dive right into impeachment. This week, Democrats triggered the start of the impeachment trial of, well, now former President Trump. It's his second impeachment trial, I might add. It's a very unique club. He's the only president to be facing two impeachment trials. There's one article of impeachment here charging Trump with incitement to insurrection over his role in the January 6th storming of the Capitol. Linda, give us the bullet points here. We'll get to the politics in a moment, but when is the trial likely to start? How long can we expect it to last? And do we have a sense of what Trump's defense might be?
The trial is due to start on February 9th, and given a vote that took place this week, that it was a measure from a Republican Senator Rand Paul trying to dismiss the trial, and that was defeated, but with only five Republican votes. So that is a very strong indication that Donald Trump will not be convicted when the trial does take place. And so the Democrats essentially just want to get this over with as quickly as possible. It might last a week. The timing is such that it obviously coincides with the beginning of President Biden's term. He faces massive crises on numerous fronts, and they don't want this to swamp Biden's agenda. As for Trump's defense, the first and foremost defense is that this is what they're doing is unconstitutional, that you can't have an impeachment trial of a president who's already left office. So they, I think, are hoping to avoid discussion of the substance of the charges, which is that he incited the riot at the Capitol on January 6th and get away from Trump's antics and inflammatory rhetoric.
The thing is, Molly, that right after the riot, you had some lawmakers on the Republican side blaming President Trump, people like Mitch McConnell, who rarely, if ever, said anything bad about Donald Trump, Kevin McCarthy, the leader of House Republicans, who has so closely aligned himself with Trump, even blamed Trump. But now you have this vote in the Senate that Linda mentioned, where most Republicans wanted to throw out the trial from the get-go. And you also seem to have Republicans who split with President Trump now walking that back. Why is that, Molly?
We've really seen the tide turn on this issue. As you said, it really did seem in the immediate aftermath of the attack, particularly before the new president was inaugurated, that there was a real willingness among Republicans, even quite senior and Republicans who'd been friendly to Trump, to turn on him and to try to sort of cast him out of the Republican Party. He remains a problem for the Republican Party going forward because of the divisions within their ranks, because you do have a sizable faction of the party that would like to reset its image because he is and has been so unpopular with the broader public. But then another sizable faction, and indeed most of the Republican rank and file Republican base, that remains quite committed and devoted to Trump. So I think the interesting questions are, as Linda mentioned, what we've heard from allies of the president is this procedural defense rather than trying to defend him on the substance, saying that on questions of process that the trial is itself illegitimate for technical reasons or for just sort of on a conceptual level that this isn't an issue we should be dealing with, we should be moving on, that if the new president wants to unite the country, he should not be focusing on these divisive questions of accountability for the past. The other thing I'm interested to hear going forward is When Trump does mount his official defense, he's retained a lawyer from South Carolina to speak for him in this matter and has a deadline coming up next week to officially answer the summons from Congress. Will he express any kind of contrition? We know he has this inability to express regret or apologize for pretty much anything. There is a real hunger among Republicans, even those who don't want to convict him, to see some sort of accountability, just to be able to say to the public, we didn't let this go unpunished since it was so serious and since lawmakers themselves were at risk.
But Molly, I just want to follow up with you. You've covered Trump these past 4 years. Do you really think he's going to apologize?
No. I don't make predictions, but that seems pretty in keeping with his personality. He's not somebody who expresses a lot of regret.
Linda, I want to go back to you. I think you both have been bringing up this point that the Democrats would like this trial to go as quick as possible, given that Republicans, they will not get, again, no predictions here. Republicans have done and said very unlikely that they'll get enough Republican support. So putting aside sort of the moral and ethical questions here about whether Trump is guilty, holding him accountable, from a purely political perspective, and we are talking about Washington politics matters here, what do Democrats gain from the trial if Trump, at the end of the day, is not convicted?
What Democrats gain is, in some ways, is a little bit of a sense of closure in their dealings with Donald Trump. Trump is no longer president, but this is them addressing one of his final acts of his presidency, which was, in the view of many, completely outrageous. So while they know that it's probably a losing proposition that they can convict him and potentially ban him from running for office again, I think they feel that what he did was just so egregious that it had to be dealt with, even if they're trying to get this over with quickly. You know, the downside for them is that it cuts into Joe Biden's message of unity, bipartisanship. There was, as Molly said, this early bipartisan agreement that what Trump had done was wrong. You did have a lot of top Republicans coming out against the president's rally on January the 6th, but that has quickly evaporated. And Donald Trump himself is now sitting in Florida and has set up his, quote, office of the former president. So he's acknowledging he's former and not really the rightfully elected president, and has had senior aides making phone calls to senators just to make sure they're still on the team, are not going to vote to convict. And oh, by the way, if you go against us, you might see a primary in your future.
We're already seeing Republicans in the House who voted to impeach. Other Republicans are trying to punish them for that. Molly, did you want to jump into something?
Yeah, I just wanted to add really quickly. I mean, the public opinion is on the Democrat side here. Convicting Trump is popular with a solid majority of the public. It's not popular with Republicans, but it is popular with the broader public, Democrats, independents, swing voters. There is a really broad sense in polls and in public opinion that Americans saw this as an egregious national tragedy and do want someone held accountable and do believe that President Trump bears some blame here. So I think there is a real opportunity for the Democrats here in the Republicans not wanting to hold Trump accountable, because they can then go to voters and say, our country was attacked, America was attacked, the American government was attacked, and our opponents here, the Republicans, simply did not want to do anything about it.
And that seems to be something that Chuck Schumer, who now leads the Senate because the Democrats have the majority, has been saying, that he wants to get Republicans on record. Even if they don't vote to convict, it can be used against them in upcoming elections. Let's pause here and we'll take a break and we'll continue the conversation on the other side.
Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel via Skype. Molly Ball, National Political Correspondent for Time Magazine. Linda Feldman, Washington Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor, and our moderator, Shayna Estulin, Political and Foreign Affairs Correspondent.
Welcome back to the show. Biden made unity a centerpiece in his inauguration speech, bringing the country back together, working with the other side. He's been in office about 10 days or so. It's not that long of a time. But in those 10 days, Linda, what steps, if any, has Biden taken to reach out to Republicans? And on the flip side, are Republicans interested in working with Biden?
Joe Biden, I don't know that he's done a whole lot of outreach yet. His main activity since taking office has been to sign a whole lot of executive orders which are things that he can just do with his signature, doesn't need congressional approval. A lot of it is the reversal of the Trump agenda, rejoining the Paris Climate Accord, canceling the Keystone XL pipeline, canceling the Muslim, so-called Muslim travel ban, reaffirming a program that was instituted under President Obama, providing deportation protection for young undocumented people in this country. One of the norms of the early days of a presidency, which is that the new president sits down and signs a whole lot of orders, either to undo the previous president from the other party or to just put in place things that he wants to really lay down that marker, things that don't need congressional approval. Of course, there's a lot that needs Congress to weigh in, and that upcoming very quickly is the COVID relief package. The pandemic is front and center on his agenda, and they are moving now to pass legislation in Congress, potentially actually as two bills, one that they are hoping to get with bipartisan support.
A lot to unpack in your answer, and we're going to touch on a lot of those points, but I want to stick with unity for a moment, Molly. Biden said he would be president for those who did not vote for him. 74 million Americans did not vote for him. It doesn't seem likely that Biden can win over people steeped in conspiracy theories, the ones who marched on the Capitol. But there are plenty of Republicans who did not think the insurrection was a good thing at all, and there are polls to back that up. But they're just not Democrats. They hold conservative ideals. They feel increasingly alienated by the mainstream discourse. So how does and can Biden win them over? And then in addition, what can be done about this growing conspiracy theory problem that's a really big internal problem for the Republicans?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of different levels to this unity question. We heard in President Biden's opening address him trying to say what he meant by this idea of unity, that it, of course, is not going to mean unanimity. It, of course, is not going to mean that everybody suddenly agrees on the direction forward for the country or how the Congress should govern when it comes to issues, or that he gets 100% of the vote the next time he's on the ballot. He doesn't expect 74 million Americans to suddenly wake up and be Democrats. But he did, he said, want to end this quote-unquote uncivil war. He wanted to, unlike his predecessor, set a unifying tone in his rhetoric and to send a message that the changes he is making to the government are intended to help everybody, that where Trump often would do things and say point blank that this was something he was doing for his supporters and not for the rest of the country, even in some cases seeking to punish blue states and their governments and their residents in the policies that he enacted. This administration is trying to say to the public, we're doing this for everyone. We want to help everyone. The policies we're making are intended to help everyone. And those 74 million who didn't support him, that he still views them as Americans who should be part of his governing vision. Now, is that convincing to people? I doubt it, frankly. And what we are seeing from Republicans is very much a replay of 2009, where they correctly saw that the president's promise of bipartisanship and coming together in Washington was something they could veto, was something that they could say, well, if we don't go along with it, look, you're not accomplishing your goal. And so we've heard a lot of rhetoric from Republicans to that end. But on the policy question, on the governing question, there are talks going on between Republicans and Democrats in the Senate to see if they can come up with some agreement. But there's also talks that are exclusively among Democrats about how they can pass the COVID relief and other policies on a party line vote. So I think it's really an open question which way this thing is going to go on Capitol Hill.
Right. And you have Republicans saying it's not all rhetoric. We want to see actual concrete steps taken by the administration, although rhetoric does matter. We've seen that in the past 4 years. And it's not all on Biden, of course, Linda. I mean, the Republican Party is having this fight internally. You have Republican Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene. A new report now says that she supported executing Democrats on her Facebook page before she was elected. That doesn't exactly scream unity. Mitt Romney, the senator from Utah, the Republican senator, he's saying that Republicans who were spreading lies about election fraud shouldn't be complaining about the Democrats inflaming and dividing the country. So the Republicans have to figure this out among themselves as well.
Absolutely. No, the Republican Party is in a state of turmoil. They're out of power from both the White House and in both chambers on Capitol Hill. You have fringe members, there's no other way to put it, people like Marjorie Taylor Greene, Lauren Boebert, these are both freshman women members. You had Lauren Boebert, you know, she carries a gun, which is controversial to say the least. And then you have the few Republican members who are willing to speak out in a very public way, like Mitt Romney, trying to kind of hold on to that old style collegial establishment Republicanism. Even if there are policy disputes, you can still have a reasonable conversation. So the party is, you know, they're trying to keep it all together, but at the same time, it's really hard in this day of social media and 24/7 media in general to keep the people that are on the fringe from getting a lot of attention.
Right. They have a massive platform on social media. Anything they can say gets retweeted and liked, et cetera. Molly, I want to go back to, Linda brought up this slate of executive orders that Biden has signed in his first days. It's funny, not haha funny, but funny in sort of a Washington way, because Obama was heavily criticized for relying on executive orders. Democrats then criticized Trump for doing the same thing. And now Biden is getting that same criticism. But sort of putting aside that criticism, is there an issue here with Congress conceding control and the executive sort of taking that control away from Congress?
Yeah, in broader terms, this is a decades-long trend, and it does, I think, it does come from both sides, right? You've had presidents increasingly seeking to act unilaterally, while Congress is increasingly gridlocked and incapable of doing anything or very much when it comes to policymaking. You know, you have the Congress saying, well, the president shouldn't be doing this. This is our job. And the president saying, well, why don't you do your job then? Why make me do it? Biden has set a record for the amount of executive orders and actions he's taken. Now just over a week on the job. Most of those executive orders, however, and actions are simply undoing or unwinding actions that Trump had taken unilaterally, because over the course of his presidency, he did on many occasions set annual records for the number of executive orders and actions that he took, which Democrats criticized as a sort of, you know, imperial presidency approach, that he simply wanted to do things unilaterally because he believed himself to be the sole authority. So, you know, if Congress wanted to take back these powers, it could. And there are some in Congress who would like to see that. And there is some legislation pending to that effect. I don't see it being a huge subject of conversation on Capitol Hill. But I think this is something that we have seen going on for years and years in terms of the balance of power between the executive and the legislative branches.
Right. And as you mentioned, it's not only that Congress is ceding control, but it also, these executive orders can be overturned with the next administration. They don't really have lasting power as legislation does. I want to go to some pieces of legislation that are pending right now, specifically the COVID relief package. Linda, I think you brought this up. It's a big bill. I think it's $1.9 trillion, if I'm not mistaken. What's in it? Any chance of it passing? What's the Biden team doing to try and get Republicans on board?
So it contains a lot related to COVID directly. It enhances the stimulus payments to Americans who make under a certain amount to kind of plus up the amount that was given in the final package of the Trump administration. That's huge. You've got money in there to ramp up production of vaccine, to enhance the distribution, to increase the number of vaccinators. And then it also contains a piece that's rather controversial, which is to establish a $15 an hour minimum wage across the country. I tend to think that was thrown in there to make a statement, and then they'll give that away when all is said and done. But that is a long-held policy goal of Democratic progressives, the left wing of the Democratic Party. And this is something that the Biden administration is very keen to do. The Democrats have their own internal divisions and wings. Just as the Republicans are trying to keep it all together, so are the Democrats. And Biden, who's the classic Democratic centrist, he knows that he's with such slim majorities in both houses of Congress, he really needs to keep all of his people on board with him, including the most liberal.
Yeah, intra-party fighting is not unique to one side. While the White House and legislatures and lawmakers sort of hash this out, this COVID relief bill, the Biden administration has also put out their broader COVID plan, the cornerstones of which are faster testing, health equality, and boosting vaccinations. It's ambitious, although some health experts say on the vaccine front, it's not ambitious enough. Biden had been promising 100 million vaccines in his first 100 days. Experts say that number has to be much larger. Biden seems to be signaling now he wants to move past that goal. In general, Molly, what challenges does Biden face rolling out his COVID plan?
pretty much all of them. You know, the Trump administration rather deservedly did not have a very good reputation in this regard. The president was notoriously disengaged with the management of the pandemic. So we have seen the new administration really scrambling to reorient the course of things. They were accused when they first came in of sort of trying to be a little too cute by half with the expectation setting. We were already at a level above a million vaccinations a day by the time Joe Biden took the oath of office. So to say that he was going to get to that level was not really setting himself anything to strive for. And we have now seen the administration increase that. But the vaccination rollout has been slow. It has been difficult. It has been inconsistent across states. There has been a lot of waste and difficulty in the process. And we see the new administration talking a big game about really sort of making this a wartime effort type of surge using FEMA and so forth. It has yet to really materialize. And I think that's going to be, the proof is going to be in the pudding of whether they can really show that they have put some urgency into this using, you know, the Defense Production Act, using disaster funds to purchase more vaccines. I think this is something we're going to see in the coming weeks and months. Are they able to really turn this around and show the American people that they're serious about making this process really work?
And to that point, politicians can spin a lot of things. And we saw this trip up Trump as well. He promised at a certain point, any American who wants to get a test can get it. But then a lot of Americans who went out and tried to get a test saw that it wasn't so easy. And the same thing is, I'm assuming, is going to happen with Biden. He's promising that by spring, any American that wants a vaccine should be able to get it. But if by spring, Americans still are having a hard time getting vaccines, mm-hmm. the blame is going to be with Biden, no matter what Trump did going in. I mean, the buck will stop with Biden on this, right, Linda?
Absolutely. I think the whole ballgame for President Biden, if he is not perceived as having made serious progress, really turning around the American response to COVID, I think his presidency is effectively over. This is such a massive crisis, and they know this. In some ways, it's been extraordinary how, you know, we seem to see the waving of a wand. The Trump team left, the Biden team came in. We're now getting regular briefings. Anthony Fauci, the infectious disease expert, can now speak freely. He's not feeling undermined and undercut by the administration. The messaging is extremely important. The public has to feel that the government at all levels is doing everything they can to get people vaccinated and to stop this.
The last question I have on this, Molly, is the challenge of getting schools open. The Biden team has said reopening schools is a priority, but they're getting a lot of pushback from school unions, from teacher unions, I should say. Teacher unions in big cities want to keep schools shut indefinitely, which goes against what the CDC is saying. A new CDC report out that you can reopen schools if you put in the right measures. It is possible to do this. You're having reports now. The New York Times just had this heartbreaking article about a spike in teen suicides. I think it was in Las Vegas. Kids can't go to school. Suicides are going up. Teachers unions have a lot of power, though, in the Democratic Party, especially on a local level. So how does Biden balance pleasing those unions? But also, there are a lot of parents who are really upset who will have a lot of power when it comes to the next election.
That's right. You know, I think that question of where the public is on this issue and where public pressure has been applied is really important, because in a lot of these districts, and the parents are the ones driving a lot of this. The policymakers who've been accused of sort of caving to the unions, they in a lot of cases have public pressure on their side. And so I think the most important thing here is going to be rebuilding the trust with the public to say, we're not politicizing this process. We are being responsive to the science, and the science says we can do this, because you have a lot of parents who just don't believe that. You have a lot of parents that when the teachers and their unions say, we don't think this is safe, they believe that, even if it's not necessarily true, because there has been so little trust in a lot of these communities, particularly those big cities that you're talking about, for the messages that were coming out of the Trump administration. So while it is true that the unions have been a big player in this, they see themselves as, you know, protecting the health and safety of their members. For example, Washington, D.C. right now trying to open schools in person, there's a real question about whether any kids are going to show up in those schools or whether parents are going to continue to choose to keep their kids home because they simply don't trust what they're hearing from the government about where the science is and whether it's safe.
It just goes to show what a challenge the Biden administration is facing, getting people to even trust the basic science that's coming out. That's all the time we have. Thanks to Molly Ball, national political correspondent for Time Magazine, and Linda Feldman, Washington Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor. I'm Shayna Stulen. This program is produced by Voice of America. Thanks for listening.
VOA, the Science Edition of Press Conference USA. Here's your host, Rick Pantaleo.
Hello, and welcome to the Science Edition of Press Conference USA. I'm Rick Pantaleo. It's been a little over a year since the World Health Organization was first notified of cases of pneumonia in Wuhan City, China, due to what was then an unknown cause. Scientists soon learned that the infecting agent was a novel or new and unknown virus that became known as SARS coronavirus 2. The disease associated with the novel coronavirus was named COVID-19. The severity of the disease ranges from having no or very mild symptoms to those who develop much more severe respiratory symptoms and other complications that have resulted in death. According to the Coronavirus Resource Center at the Johns Hopkins University of Medicine, so far there have been more than 96 million cases of COVID-19 and over 2 million deaths globally that have been attributed to the novel coronavirus. COVID-19 has touched virtually every aspect of daily life. National, regional, and local government leaders have put unprecedented policies into effect to help mitigate the spread of COVID-19. The pandemic continues to affect the global economy, with the world's financial markets experiencing extreme volatility and uncertainty. As a result, a significant number of businesses have already closed, and many more could close soon. With the pandemic's severe impact on business, many people have either lost or will lose their jobs. Schools have been forced to develop and enact remote distance learning measures so that students can continue their education. The number of COVID-19 cases and deaths throughout the pandemic has peaked and dipped. However, daily cases and deaths have been steadily and significantly rising since this past autumn. As people are bombarded each day with bad news due to COVID-19, a ray of hope signaling a possible end to the pandemic is being made with the recent release and distribution of several vaccines. Public health officials and medical researchers initially forecast that it would be at least a year and a half to several years before any COVID-19 vaccine would be made available to the public. But following urgent public and private efforts and large investments in research, several vaccines were developed and approved for widespread public vaccination campaigns. Other vaccines are still in development and may become available in the coming weeks and months. So today, we'll get an update on the COVID-19 pandemic, talk about how health professionals are handling the crisis, and learn about the available and developing coronavirus vaccines that may lead to an end to this deadly scourge. My guest who joins me by Microsoft Teams is Dr. Lisa Maragakis, MD. Dr. Maragakis is the Senior Director of Infection Prevention with the Johns Hopkins Health System and an Associate Professor of Medicine at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine in Baltimore, Maryland. Dr. Maragakis, we're about 2 months away from the first anniversary of the WHO-declared COVID-19 pandemic. Did you expect the outbreak to be as widespread and severe as it's become?
You know, I think it would have been impossible to predict the magnitude of the COVID-19 pandemic when it first began. There were initially a lot of discussions about the mortality rate and whether it was high enough to cause a significant degree of harm. But of course, now in hindsight, it's very clear that this virus has a unique set of characteristics, the ability to spread among people without causing symptoms. And ironically, its mortality rate being around 1% instead of much higher, as other viruses might have, actually allows it to spread far and wide, as we have seen, and to cause very large magnitude disaster that we are still contending with today.
Dr. Maragakis, can you please share with us your thoughts on the pandemic at its beginning through where we are today? What have you learned throughout this past year?
Well, it has been such a challenging year for people around the world for so many reasons. We have learned about this virus at an unprecedented rate. So I think we can be very grateful to the scientists the world over who have collaborated and worked at record speeds to discover very basic information about the virus, how it's transmitted, and to develop therapeutics and vaccines. So that is the good side of things. But of course, many, many challenges remain, and we are really in a race with this virus. As we know, viruses like this continue to mutate, for example. And so much of the discussion now is around some of the mutations that have emerged, some of the variant strains, and we are really in a race to disseminate, distribute vaccines, and to try to protect the world population before we face even more challenges.
Dr. Maragakis, speaking of mutated versions of the SARS-2 coronavirus, one mutation that seems to be spreading is a more infectious strain some call the UK variation. And now I'm hearing about another variation coming from California. Can you tell me what this is and how it was detected and why it spreads much more easily than the pre-mutated version?
Well, we continue to learn more about these different variants, but essentially, what we're talking about are versions of the virus that have mutated, which is a normal process. As the virus makes copies of itself, small mistakes are made, and some of them turn out to be advantageous to the virus in order to escape immune detection, or in this case, to be transmitted more easily. It seems that the individuals with the UK strain, for instance, have higher amounts of virus in their upper airways, which makes it more transmissible to other people who are around them. And so once this mutation emerged among the viruses in the UK, within a very short period of time, on the order of 2 to 3 months, it became the predominant variant that was being transmitted among people in the UK. The mutations we're talking about alter the part of the virus that is detected by our immune system that's called the spike protein. Mm-hmm. And in particular, a region of that protein that is like the lock and key that lets the virus enter human cells. And that's why we are quite concerned that we get everyone vaccinated and also control transmission through the very basic infection prevention measures of masking and physical distancing so that we limit the ability of more mutations to emerge.
Speaking of the UK variation, again, it's been known to spread much more easier than other strains of the virus. Is it just as serious as the original strain that started out about a year ago? And does it have the symptoms? Are they more serious or less serious?
So far, these variants don't appear to be more serious in terms of the types of symptoms that they cause or the severity of illness or risk of death. And so that is good news. We are grateful that these changes haven't apparently yet caused more severe disease. So the main advantage that the virus seems to have in this case is to be more easily transmitted because of that higher viral load or amount that's in the upper airways.
Dr. Maragakis, looking at the charts of infections, deaths over the past year, I've seen peaks and dips in the number of people contracting COVID-19 each day over the past year. Can you explain why recent statistics, at least here in the U.S., seem to indicate that the number of new cases has doubled or almost tripled that of earlier higher peaks?
It's one of the most frustrating things, watching the pandemic unfold, to see it attack new geographic areas. One of the things that we are seeing in the United States that has caused the fall numbers to be so dramatically higher than in the spring is that the geographic spread is much greater this time in the second part of the surge than it was in the first surge, where it was more concentrated in New York and more limited geographic areas. So that's one reason. But I think another reason is really related to what we know about respiratory viruses, that they do typically increase in the fall and winter months when the weather is colder and drier and people gather indoors and are in closer contact with each other. And we also have had a series of holidays that we saw a lot of people gathering to celebrate and traveling. So all of these factors come together. And right now, in the United States, at least, it has really led to an overwhelming surge.
So what role do you think that pandemic fatigue has played in the boost in the number of cases?
Pandemic fatigue is a very important factor to discuss because it relates to these very basic infection prevention practices that are our very best tools right now to protect ourselves and our communities and our families. And that's the very simple acts of wearing a mask, physical distancing, and washing our hands and avoiding large gatherings indoors. So these are messages that people have heard again and again and again, and we're tired. It's been over a year now that we have been asked to do these things, and they're difficult. You really have to change your behaviors, and they interfere, of course, with certain things that we want to do. So people are tired, understandably, but I think it is important to remember that we have the vaccines on the horizon. Vaccine distribution and administration is underway, and we really need some patience and perseverance to keep up the infection prevention practices for a bit longer.
One of the questions that came up at the beginning of the pandemic, and it's still a question that people are wondering, some of the people who get infected with the coronavirus suffer either no or some mild symptoms, while others suffer from much more severe and even deadly forms of COVID-19. Other than some of the previous risk factors like being over 65, being obese, having diabetes, high blood pressure, and so on, have researchers been able to determine what causes for mild symptoms in one person while another person has much more serious symptoms?
This is one of the mysteries of this viral illness for which we will need further research and continue learning as we go forward. In general, I can point to a couple of things, though, that we do know. So in addition to those risk factors that you mentioned, so obesity and having underlying conditions like diabetes or heart disease or lung disease, which make you more vulnerable to the severe forms of the disease, we also know that the amount of virus at the beginning of your exposure can play a role in the severity of disease. And so this is one of the reasons it's important to wear a mask, because the mask is a barrier that even if it doesn't protect you completely from catching the infection, it can still limit the amount of virus that is inoculated or inhaled into your airways. And we know that breathing in a higher quantity of virus at the beginning can be correlated with more severe disease. But then there are a variety of other parts of your immune system response that may also play a role. And this is a very complex system, how your body fights off infections. And what we know is that you can have severe forms of the disease if you have too little immune response, but also if you have an overactive immune response as well, ironically.
Speaking of the immune system reacting, there's a term that they use for that.
So I believe you're probably talking about the cytokine storm, which is a term that is used for a very over-exuberant immune response. And cytokines are chemicals that the immune system or the body uses to activate the immune system and to alert it that an invader or a pathogen is present and to stimulate a fight against that invader. But when you get a storm or a flood of these chemicals, it can really lead to a very robust immune system response that causes more damage to human tissues, to your own body, in the process of trying to respond to the virus.
Let's take a break now. You're listening to the Science Edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. I'm Rick Pantaleo. Here's a reminder that Press Conference USA is available for free download from our website, voanews.com/PCUSA, and many streaming services such as Apple Podcasts. If you have access to the internet, please check out our Facebook and Twitter pages at Carol Castiel, VOA, for alerts and program updates. Let's get back to the Science Edition of Press Conference USA. Today, we're getting an update on the COVID-19 pandemic, talking about how health professionals are handling the crisis and learning about the available and developing coronavirus vaccines that may lead to an end to this deadly scourge. My guest who joins me by Microsoft Teams is Dr. Lisa Marigakis, MD. Dr. Marigakis is the Senior Director of Infection Prevention with the Johns Hopkins Health System and an Associate Professor of Medicine at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine in Baltimore, Maryland. Dr. Marigakis, let's talk a little about the treatments for COVID-19. How is it typically treated among those with mild to those with deadly symptoms? I'm sure the treatment varies with the severity.
Treatment definitely varies with severity. So one thing to know is that the vast majority of people who have COVID-19 will either have no symptoms or mild symptoms. So that is the good news, although we all have to be vigilant that even under those conditions, you can still transmit the virus to others. And that's why it's important to be very vigilant for any symptoms and to do the kind of contact tracing, quarantine and isolation precautions, even for mild illness. But for individuals who have more severe symptoms, many of those can recover at home. One thing that we do suggest, however, is if you have access to a small device to measure your blood oxygen level, and this is just like a little sensor that can be placed on the tip of your finger, that can be very helpful to make sure that if you are short of breath and developing respiratory symptoms, that you don't reach that critical level where you need to seek a higher level of care and go to the doctor or possibly even be admitted to the hospital. And then once patients really have more severe symptoms, they might qualify for some of the therapies. Some of these now, such as monoclonal antibody, are available in limited supplies to be given to patients who don't need hospitalization, but who were recently diagnosed with COVID-19. And then for hospitalized patients, we have gotten much better over this year in knowing how to support their breathing functions, their respiratory status, and we do have therapies now that can try to work directly against the virus and also control that immune response if it gets too overactive.
Treatments that are available right now, does it help lower the impact of COVID on the body? Because I understand along with respiratory illness, it has many effects on the human body, including the brain, the heart, the muscles, whatever. Does this treatment also look out for that as well?
Absolutely. So our number one goal in treating patients who have COVID-19 is to support them, to offer what we call supportive care. And often that does require, for more severe cases, hospitalization or even intensive care unit care and mechanical ventilation for some of those patients. So you're right, many body systems can be affected, and we do have to support patients as their own immune system fights the infection. We do have some therapies as well that can work as antiviral agents, trying to really suppress the virus from being able to replicate itself. And then other therapies that are effective for those patients who have a cytokine storm or a really strong immune reaction that try to suppress that immune system response. I know that sounds a little ironic when you're fighting an infection, but we try to support the patients and make sure that their own immune response doesn't cause more damage than good.
Looking at what researchers are developing, what promising treatments are in the pipeline still to come regarding COVID-19? What are you seeing?
You know, we've talked about the different classes of medications that can be helpful, but there are also a lot of ways that we can support the patients and take care of their breathing function and support them without putting them on mechanical ventilation. So that has been one of the biggest breakthroughs, I think, is to reduce the number of patients that have to use a mechanical ventilator, because we know that in and of itself makes it harder for some patients to eventually recover and get off of the mechanical ventilation, for instance. So these are things like non-invasive ways to support breathing and increase their oxygenation without putting them on a full ventilator. Then there are research studies and candidate therapies that are also being studied. Again, I would say that the scientific advances have been really unprecedented during this pandemic response. So I would anticipate that we will see other types of therapeutics, probably in those major categories of antiviral agents that attack the virus itself, what we call immunomodulator agents that control the overactive immune response, and perhaps other therapies as well.
Dr. Mirogakis, now let's talk about an area of the pandemic that is giving people around the world some hope about an end to the pandemic, and that's the vaccines. And there have been a number of vaccines that have been developing, including those for use and those still in testing. And I understand there are four types of COVID vaccines. What are they? How do they work, and what are some of the pros and cons of each?
Well, I'll start off by saying that we are so hopeful because of the arrival of these vaccines. And it has broken all previous records to have vaccines available in such a short period of time. And I know this has seemed like the longest year, but it is really miraculous that we already have so many different vaccines that are available and being administered to people and also others on the horizon. So as you mentioned, there are different kinds of vaccines, and some of the vaccine platforms have been used for a very long period of time and for other pathogens. And so these include vaccines that are what I will call viral vector vaccines. And that means you take some other kind of virus, not the coronavirus, but a different kind of virus that does not cause disease, and you modify it so that it will actually basically instruct the person's immune system to recognize proteins of the coronavirus and to make it mount an immune response. All of the different kinds of vaccines really use different strategies in order to teach your immune system to recognize proteins from the pathogen of interest, in this case, the coronavirus. So a viral vector is one way to do that. You can also have protein subunit vaccines that are a mixture of proteins themselves with other substances that stimulate the immune system and response. But one of the most exciting and new platforms is something called messenger RNA vaccines, or mRNA. And these are two of the types of vaccine that are now under emergency use authorization in the United States and are beginning to be distributed and administered. And the messenger RNA is a relatively new platform. It's been developed over the last several years and for other pathogens, and was adapted and is the first time that it is being used or authorized for a virus, in this case, the coronavirus. And what messenger RNA is a substance, it's a biological substance that instructs your own cells to make proteins. And the code for the protein is that of the spike protein of the coronavirus. And so after getting one of these vaccines, your cell machinery in the area of the vaccine starts pumping out copies of the spike protein. And that's a trigger for your immune system to respond and to make antibodies and a reaction that will then recognize any of these vaccines then are to train your immune system to recognize the virus itself and react and protect you.
In the United States, there are two vaccines that have been authorized for emergency use, as you mentioned, the Pfizer-BioNTech and Moderna. I understand they're both using the mRNA platform.
Yes, that's correct. Both the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines are examples of that messenger RNA, mRNA platform.
Speaking of rolling out the vaccine to throughout the world, again, the two U.S. vaccines require a lot of care in storage and transportation. Are there vaccines available that can be just taken off the shelf and used?
Yes. So you're mentioning one of the major limitations of this new vaccine platform, the messenger RNA. And that is that it is a substance that requires very, very careful handling, and what we call cold chain or storage at extremely cold temperatures. And that is logistically very difficult to keep a vial of vaccine frozen at such low temperatures as it is transported from one place to another and as it is stored and then administered to individuals. So a lot of logistics challenges around the mRNA vaccines, as miraculous as they are. Thankfully, there are many of these other more traditional vaccine platforms that do not require that level of frozen storage and transportation. And so I think it will be very important that we utilize those, particularly in parts of the world that will have even more challenges maintaining that kind of a cold chain distribution channel and administration channel that I just mentioned.
And going back a little bit to the mutated versions of COVID-19, I have heard that the current vaccines are also effective against the mutated strains. If so, how do scientists know this to be true?
So the variants are causing quite a bit of concern in this regard. We, as I mentioned, are in a race really to against the virus to try to control it and get everyone vaccinated before mutations emerge that will escape from our current and future vaccines and therapeutics. You're correct that right now the data that have been published are reassuring so far that our vaccines will still be effective against the variants. But ongoing research is examining this. And it's a hard question to answer because there are a variety of mutations in the different variants. We have the UK variant. Somewhat more concerning have been variants detected in South Africa and Brazil that have more mutations, and ones that are in that critical receptor binding domain of the spike protein, that lock and key that allows the virus to enter our cells. So the possibility still remains that the virus will develop mutations that may escape our vaccines. The good news about that is that we can adapt our vaccine strategy. That would take time, and it would be very unfortunate if we had to do it, but it is possible.
Speaking of immunizations, I know there are some diseases and some immunizations that require boosters after a few years. Will people who get COVID vaccines today require a booster sometime down the line?
We believe that will be very likely. We don't yet know how long the immunity will last following really either natural infection or vaccination, and it may vary from certain types of the vaccines, but it is likely, we believe, that a booster will be required at some interval. We can't yet say what that would be. The other thing to mention is that some of the vaccines require two doses, and that is another thing about the mRNA platform. Both the Pfizer and the Moderna vaccines require two doses, and some of the other vaccines on the horizon are only one dose, which, of course, is logistically easier to administer.
And finally, Dr. Maragakis, with the distribution of vaccines and other findings being developed, we are finally starting to see a light at the end of the tunnel regarding the pandemic. Do you see that, or do we still have a long way to go?
I do see that. I am cautiously optimistic that the rollout of the vaccines, the availability of them will increase, and that we will begin to get a handle on this in the coming months and see the end of the pandemic. I would caution, however, that we must move as rapidly as we can to vaccinate as many people as we can in the coming weeks and months. And for all the reasons we've discussed today, there are some challenges with that. And I would say that as tired as we all are, that we really need patience and perseverance with infection prevention precautions along the way so that we can use every means at our disposal to get control of the viral transmission, preserve our healthcare resources, and save lives.
One of the people who are at the forefront of the science behind COVID-19 and the science behind prevention is Dr. Anthony Fauci, who's director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. I remember reading he had said that perhaps by fall, people can go back to church and start singing together again. That sounds very optimistic. Do you share his thoughts?
Well, wouldn't that be wonderful? I certainly hope that he is right. I have so much respect for Dr. Fauci, and I would say that that is a wonderful goal, and we are working very hard every day to move as quickly as possible to try to achieve that goal. So I hope so.
Dr. Maragakis, thank you so much for the work that you and your colleagues have been doing to fight this terrible pandemic. And I want to thank you very much for taking time from your schedule to talk to us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Dr. Lisa Maragakis, MD. She's the Senior Director of Infection Prevention with the Johns Hopkins Health System and an Associate Professor of Medicine at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine in Baltimore, Maryland. She joined our program today via Microsoft Teams. This is Rick Pantaleo. Thanks for listening today, and be sure to join Carol Castiel again next week for another edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.
This is VOA News via remote. I'm Liz Pelka. Thousands of